The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. On stage in the 80s musical Dreamgirls, and later on in the film Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit, and on the show Moesha. More recently, she's been getting a steady drumbeat of love for her portrayal of beloved teacher Barbara Howard on ABC's Abbott Elementary. This past fall, Ralph even scored an Emmy Award in the Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series category, making her the second Black woman ever to take home that honor. Her empowering acceptance speech, that included a song, tugged at heartstrings, flooring everyone, including Oprah. More recently, her vocal prowess wowed at Super Bowl 57 with her rendition of the song Lift Every Voice and Sing. And, as if she weren't busy enough, the star recently announced a partnership with the sanitizer Microband 24, which she started using early in the pandemic. It has been with me on every plane. It has been on every hotel surface. I'm telling you, I spray everything in my hotel rooms. I'm that girl, she says. We recently caught up with Ralph, who shared what's left on our bucket list, what she's most proud of, and more. We're guessing you've crossed a lot off your bucket list over the past several years. What's left on it? I was talking to my good girlfriend yesterday, and she really travels. She gets out there, and she travels. And I said, you know something, Jennifer? I've got to make use of time and travel much, much more. I have a home in Jamaica, so I'm there very often. But I'm like, you know what? Now I've got to go start traveling to some other places. I've got to see more of the world. I've got to see the Taj Mahal. I really want to see it. I want to see the Sphinx. I want to see the temples before they're gone. I want to experience Venice again before it sinks. I just want to travel more. You've accomplished so much. What are you most proud of? I'm proud of my marriage. I'm proud that my husband and I are still in love and still in like and still moving forward together as a couple. When people say proudest of, I truly am very proud of both of my children. The fact that my children do not live at home, do not ask me for money, and do not embarrass me in public. I'm very proud of that. I'm not as proud of raising my dog. I just haven't been very successful at that. I'm a dog person, but I can't seem to train a dog. What's something that you're sure of, even though you don't have proof? I know for sure that I am enough. I know for sure that if I listen to the little voice, if I listen to that, my gut, that it will never ever steer me wrong. I know for sure that if I walk in my joy, if I respect myself, that everything is going to be okay for me. I know that for sure. And I also know everything always works out for me, even if it causes me a tear or two. It always works out. I know that for sure. What's the most thoughtful thing anyone's ever done for you? Wow, I have to tell you, it was weeks after everything, after the Emmys, and I was taking in the moment. I got a call from a friend who simply asked, with all this going on and everybody's asking you everything, I just have to ask you, how are you? And I just thought that was so right on and so sweet. Just the simple question, how are you? And I really appreciated that a lot. What is your definition of love? Oh my God, love is looking in the mirror and respecting what you see, accepting what you see, empowering what you see, encouraging what you see. Because you see, if you can do all of that for what you were looking at in the mirror, oh, the amount of love, true love, unconditional love you will be able to experience. Not just for that person, but the ability to share it with others. Come on, girl, come on. Now that's some love right there. You love what you see in the mirror, love it, respect it, uplift it, encourage it. And don't act like it can't be done. Don't act like it's some joke. Don't act like, well, that's just being selfish. Don't act like, oh, well, that's just easy for you. No, honey, I do not look like my journey, and you do not know what storms and rivers I have had to cross. But I have always believed. I might sink now and then, but I will rise. I might be in some dangerous spaces, but I will come through it, and I will put in the work to prepare myself for the ups and downs of life. You've got to put in the work on you, baby, to get to that love. This interview has been edited and condensed for clarity. Our next article by Amanda Mitchell, Ariana Davis, and Jane Burnett is titled Everything We Know About the Little Mermaid Live Action Remake. You know the story well. A beautiful mermaid with a stunning voice gives away her gift to an evil underwater witch in order to experience what it's like to be a part of that world and find true love. The Little Mermaid is the animated film that launched the Disney Renaissance, a 10-year golden era that turned out hit after hit for the movie studio in the late 80s and 90s. More than 30 years later, the film is getting a hotly anticipated live-action remake, and its May 2023 premiere is almost here. Halle Bailey, who plays Ariel herself, marked the start of the 100-day countdown by excitedly sharing the second teaser, and it already has hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube. The original teaser trailer was revealed at the D23 Expo 2022 last fall and inspired Black kids everywhere who rarely get to see themselves as Disney's main characters. In 2019, Disney announced that it cast Bailey for the leading role, which, despite causing some controversy, thanks to fans who took issue with Ariel being played by a Black woman, mostly inspired celebration. She's only the second Black actor to ever be cast as a Disney princess. I feel like I'm dreaming and I'm just grateful and I don't pay attention to the negativity, Bailey told Variety at the Power of Young Hollywood Gala after the announcement. I feel like this role was something bigger than me and greater, and it's going to be beautiful. I'm just so excited to be a part of it. And years after it was revealed Bailey got the big part, she finally shared a few sneak peeks of her as Ariel. We'll be honest, the snap not only depicts a shadowy oceanside silhouette, but it also taken from a bit of a distance, so we can't see much. But from what we can tell, this remake will be epic. In an Instagram caption to go along with the snap, Bailey revealed that she'd just wrapped filming. After auditioning for the film when I was 18, just about to turn 19, to now finishing filming through a pandemic when I turned 21, we have finally made it, she said. I feel so grateful to have experienced this film in all of its glory. It has been the toughest experience being away from everything and everyone I've ever known, to feeling self-doubt, loneliness, but also feeling such freedom and perseverance as I've reached the end. This experience has made me so much stronger than I ever thought I could be. Disney has unveiled the rest of the full cast, as well as other changes that are on the way. If you're ready to go under the sea, here's a deep dive, pun intended, into everything we know about the Little Mermaid live-action remake movie so far. Who's in the cast of the live-action Little Mermaid? We already know about Halle Bailey playing Ariel, but what about the rest of the cast? Jonah Howard King will be Prince Eric, and is a dead ringer for the animated character, if we say so ourselves. Previously, the 25-year-old British actor starred as Laurie in a Little Woman remake, no, not Greta Gerwig's film, and the period drama World on Fire. The rest of the cast is equally on point. Academy Award-winning actor Javier Bardem will be Ariel's stern father, King Triton, and Melissa McCarthy, who is most often giving us side cramps in comedies like Spy, we'll try out villain mode as Ursula the Sea Witch. I've seen The Little Mermaid like 9 billion times, strangely, so to get to play Ursula was like a dream come true, McCarthy told Yahoo. I've kind of fallen in love with her. Then there are Ariel's sidekicks. Crazy Rich Asians Awkwafina will be Scuttle, the seagull expert of the human world. Jacob Tremblay from Wonder will be perfect as Flounder, Ariel's fishy bestie. Finally, we can't wait for Hamilton's Daveed Diggs version of Kiss the Girl as Sebastian the Crab. A Disney veteran will be directing The Little Mermaid. Chicago director Rob Marshall is directing the film, which comes from a script written by Jane Goldman, who previously wrote Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children and The Woman in Black. Marshall is no stranger to Disney, having directed Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, Into the Woods, and Mary Poppins Returns. Lin-Manuel Miranda will rework the soundtrack. Another major name is also attached to the film. The Little Mermaid superfan Lin-Manuel Miranda is set to produce the film alongside Mark Platt. He's also teaming up with the original 1989 film's composer, Alan Menken, to rework songs from the animated movie, as well as composing new songs for the soundtrack. Macon won 2 Oscars for his Little Mermaid score, including the Best Original Song for Under the Sea. When will the Little Mermaid remake hit theaters? The film premieres on May 26, 2023. While you wait, you can check the 1989 version of The Little Mermaid on Disney+. Sure, you won't get to hear Poor Unfortunate Souls, and the story is very different, so if that's not enough to tide you over while you wait, go ahead and give the original a rewatch or two. Just don't blame us if Under the Sea gets stuck in your head for the rest of the day. Our next article by Shelby Copeland is titled, Gayle King Reminds Us That She Is Not Signing Off from the News Anytime Soon. Gayle King was a curious storyteller long before she entered the news business. What came as part of a revelation for her was that she could make a thriving career out of her shrewd talents, and even more so, that she could be awarded for it. The CBS Mornings co-host's decades-long journey of doing what she absolutely loves, and doing it well, has earned her the honor of being chosen as the 39th recipient of the prestigious Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism. The announcement was first made on the morning broadcast in September of last year that Gayle would join the ranks of esteemed journalists like past recipients Robin Roberts and Anderson Cooper to be recognized in a luncheon ceremony hosted by Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication on February 21st in Phoenix. The 2-day trip began with a packed schedule of local visits, talks with students, and ceremonial events that all left Gayle feeling a bit intimidated by Tuesday morning as she was putting the final touches on her speech. Being the modest person she is, our editor-at-large was a little uncomfortable to be the cause of such a big fuss. Gayle's CBS team, friends, and family, including her favorite son Will and favorite daughter Kirby, who made her way through a TSA security line for the first time in 3 years just for this, were all by her side to celebrate and assure Gayle just how worthy she is of all the fuss. She has been in this business for over 4 decades and continues to crush it, Kirby told Oprah Daily just before the luncheon. And Will noted, "This is a big, big deal, and we are so honored and so proud, and we adore her. She keeps getting better and better, and just when you think she reaches the top, she goes past it." And although Oprah couldn't travel to be there in person for the ceremony, she still found a way to share how proud she was of her best friend. In a video played live, Oprah said, "I do not know of anybody more deserving of this award than you, because I do not know of another human being on the planet Earth that is more curious, more compassionate, more caring of other people's stories. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it," Gayle said on her way out of Phoenix, finally taking a moment to let the enormity of the honor sink in. "It's a big deal. Earlier this morning, someone told me, it's like your Oscar." Gayle, who maintains that she doesn't do her job to get awards, had to admit that this was a biggie. Another person along the way let her know that this was going to be her best day ever after hearing the news. And to that, Gayle responds, "It's definitely one of the best days of my life." "We are so proud of you, Gayle. Congratulations on this well-deserved honor." Gayle took a moment to share a few words of acceptance. See a few highlights from her remarks below. On her dad's influence on her love of news. "I was in 7th grade when I discovered Walter Cronkite. How? Because my dad had an unbreakable rule that we had to watch the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite at 6:30 every night as a family. That was not my idea of a good time. I thought Walter Cronkite and the news were so boring. It was important to know what was going on in the world. My dad had no idea how he was preparing me. Night after night, Walter Cronkite came into the living room reporting the news, and people trusted that he was giving them the truth. My dad was one of those people. He passed away when I was a freshman in college, but I can't help thinking of him today because I know he would be so proud of this moment. A, that I even work at CBS, which was his network, and B, for him to see me standing here getting the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism. And I have to say, I no longer think that the news is boring. Covering the news is my happy place." On how teamwork really makes the dream work. "May I just say something about my CBS Mornings team of producers, cameramen, editors, directors, researchers, hair and makeup. Thank you, Jesus. We are truly a tight unit. And I know my bias is showing, but I think one of the best in morning television. Just the other day, the way we work and look out for each other was on full display. Picture this. 45 minutes before air, there is a technical issue at the Times Square studio, and broadcasting from there was not an option. And within 45 minutes, we had to move the show, the guests, and everybody to the old broadcast center. And let's just say it wasn't next door. And I don't know how we did it, but we pulled it off and got on the air on time. There aren't enough thank yous I could give to express my gratitude. In her speech, Gail did take special care to give some individual shout-outs to those who helped her make big strides in her career, including CBS Mornings executive producer Shauna Thomas, CBS trailblazer Susan Zirinsky, and CNN's Chris Licht. On why she's not going anywhere. Walter Cronkite was 65 years old when he signed off from the CBS Evening News in March of 1981. And guess what? I'm 68 years old, and I'm not even close to signing off. The big bosses, Nareej Kimlani, president and co-head of CBS News and Stations, and George Cheeks, president and CEO of CBS and chief content officer, News and Sports, are always in the room where it happens because they make things happen. I want to thank them for their leadership and my employment. I am honored to have a seat at the CBS Mornings table, and retirement is the last thing on my mind. And that's the way it is, as Walter would say. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe and Jane Burnett is titled 31 Little Known Black History Facts You May Not Have Learned in School. From the hidden figures who made an impact, essential black inventors, change-making civil rights leaders, award-winning authors, and show-stopping 21st century women, black American history is incredibly rich. Resources like blackpast.org, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and the Library of Congress are great ways to learn little-known facts about black history and broaden your understanding of the culture. We've gathered a few choice bits of trivia spanning various topics that will inspire you to take your research well beyond Black History Month and share the information with friends and family. You'll never run out of things to learn, and who knows, these iconic figures might even motivate you to shoot for the stars in your own life and career. Literature. Number one, Phyllis Wheatley was the first African American to publish a book of poetry, poems on various subjects, religious and moral, in 1773. Born in the Gambia and sold to the Wheatley family in Boston when she was 7 years old, Wheatley was emancipated shortly after her book was released. Number two, Barr's Fight, written by poet and activist Lucy Terry in 1746, was the first known poem written by a black American. Terry was enslaved in Rhode Island as a toddler, but became free at age 26 after marrying a free black man. Number three, Clotel, the President's Daughter, was the first novel published by an African American in 1853. It was written by abolitionist and lecturer Williams Wells Brown. Important figures. Number one, in case you didn't already know, the creator of Black History Month was historian Carter G. Woodson. Often referred to as the father of black history, he was notably the second African American to graduate from Harvard University with a doctorate degree, and is credited with being one of the first scholars to study and research the history of African Americans. Number two, William Tucker was the first known black person to be born in the 13 colonies. He was born in Jamestown, Virginia in 1624. According to blackpast.org, his parents were indentured servants and part of the first group of Africans brought to colonial soil by Great Britain. Number three, after years of remarkable work as an attorney, Thurgood Marshall became the first African American to serve in the U.S. Supreme Court. Officially nominated by President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1967, he served as a justice until 1991. Number four, in 1854, John Mercer Langston notably became the first African-American lawyer in the state of Ohio. He went on to serve as the dean of the law department and vice president of Howard University. He's also remembered as the first African-American from Virginia to be elected to public office, specifically to the U.S. Congress. Number five, Anthony Benezet, a white Quaker, abolitionist, and educator, is credited with creating the first public school for African American children in the early 1770s. Number six, after graduating from Oberlin College in 1850 with a literary degree, Lucy Stanton became the first Black woman in America to earn a four-year college degree. Number seven, Martin Luther King Jr. started as a freshman at Morehouse College at the young age of 15. Number eight, James McCune Smith was the first African-American person to earn a medical degree. He also started the nation's first pharmacy under Black ownership and was the first African-American to have their work published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. Number nine, after attending Barnard College, Lila Fenwick graduated from Harvard Law School in 1956, becoming the first African-American woman to graduate from the prestigious legal institution. She also later studied at the London School of Economics and worked at the United Nations. Number 10, Hiram Rhodes Revels was sworn in as the first Black U.S. Senator in 1870. Number 11, Guillaume Bluford became the first Black person in space in 1983 and would spend 688 hours there over the course of his career as an astronaut. Music and television. Number 1, dubbed hip-hop's first godmother by Billboard, singer and music producer Sylvia Robinson produced the first ever commercially successful rap record, Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, and along with her husband, she co-owned the first hip-hop label, Sugar Hill Records. Number 2, renowned singer and jazz pianist Nat King Cole was the first Black American to host a TV show, NBC's The Nat King Cole Show. Number 3, in 1981, broadcast journalist Bryant Gumbel became the first Black person to host a network morning show when he joined NBC's Today Show. Number 4, in 1940, Hattie McDaniel became the first Black person to win an Oscar for her supporting role in Gone with the Wind. 24 years later, Sidney Poitier became the first Black man to win an Oscar for his leading role in Lilies of the Field. Inventors. Number 1, Madam C.J. Walker created a line of hair care products for African-American women, leading her to later become the first female African-American self-made millionaire. There is now a Netflix series based upon her journey titled Self-Made. Number 2, computer Lisa Galopter assisted with the 1995 creation of Shockwave, essential technology that led to the development of web animation. So we have her to thank for gifts. Number 3, agricultural scientist George Carver was responsible for creating over 500 new products made from peanuts and sweet potatoes, including cooking oils, paint, and soap. Sports. Number 1, in 1960, Wilma Rudolph of Clarksville, Tennessee, won with the new record time of 11.3 seconds in the women's 100-meter dash in Rome, 1960. Number 2, in 1908, after winning the 4x400-meter relay, John Taylor became the first African-American to win gold in the Olympics. And in 1948, Alice Coachman became the first Black woman in the world to win an Olympic gold medal while competing in the high jump. Number 3, founded in 1984, the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo is the only touring African-American rodeo in the world. Number 4, in 1920, Fritz Pollard and Bobby Marshall became the first Black athletes to play in the NFL. Pollard was also the league's first Black coach. Number 5, George Coleman Pogue became the first Black person to earn a medal at the Olympic Games in 1904. He was a hurdler. Number 6, in 1996, Cheryl Swoopes became the first player to sign with the WNBA, with the league debuting a year later. Society and Life. First published in 1936, the Negro Motorist Green Book was a comprehensive guide for Black travelers about locations across America and eventually overseas that were either Black-owned or didn't engage in segregationist practices. The guide was printed for 30 years. It stopped publication in 1966, 2 years after the Civil Rights Act was passed. Number 2, the oldest Black female Greek letter organization, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Inc., or AKA, was founded at Howard University in 1908. Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Inc., or Alpha, The first black male Greek letter organization was founded in 1906 at Cornell University. Number three, it's estimated that around 100,000 enslaved people escaped to the North via the Underground Railroad from 1810 to 1850. Number four, in July 1777, Vermont became the first colony to ban slavery. To learn about more important figures, read Lift Every Voice, A Celebration of Black Lives, which is a foreword from Oprah. The collection presents interviews with the oldest generation of Black Americans about their lives, their experiences, and the wisdom that can carry all of us to a better future. Our next article by Richard Morgan is titled Portrait of a Congressman. One of the youngest elected officials in New York City history, and now the U.S. representative for New York's 15th congressional district in the Bronx, Richie Torres is fighting for the community he calls home. Congressman Richie Torres is trying to be normal, bless his heart. He's standing in line at the U.S. Capitol's on-site Dunkin' on a recent Tuesday morning, waiting to order his breakfast of a small macchiato with almond milk. Suddenly, the man standing in front of him, a young aide to a Florida congresswoman, lights up with recognition. "I've been hoping to run into you," he tells Torres. "You're such an inspiration. You're a trendsetter for so many people like me." Then, as the aide realizes he is creating a small scene, he picks up his voice as he looks around and points dramatically to Torres, who is 34. "This man will be Speaker of the House someday," the aide announces to the few dozen people in the coffee shop. Torres blushes and finds himself at a rare loss for words. The New York Times has called Torres a superstar and perhaps the most singular political talent of his generation. A Politico reporter called him one of the most consistently sharp questioners in Congress, and Newsweek reported that some whisper he'll be the country's first gay president. New York Governor Kathy Hochul considered him for her lieutenant governor. Stories about him are built around what some leaders of his party declare as his most special quality. He's the first openly gay Afro-Latino member of Congress. Anchors on GMA3 once said it three times in 70 seconds. That kind of fawning attention can make him seem like a political darling, but his 2020 congressional bid succeeded without the support of his local Democratic Party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or an endorsement from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the famous young congresswoman whose district abuts Torres's and who has a side hustle anointing fellow Democrats as AOC approved. She declined to be interviewed for this article. Torres raised $1.7 million and won anyway. "I'm emboldened by low expectations. I invite people to underestimate me," Torres tells me. While it's true that Torres is alone on Capitol Hill in the combination of his ethnic identity and sexual orientation, what makes him extraordinary is how empirically ordinary he is. In a legislative body stacked disproportionately with dynasties, Ivy Leaguers, and millionaires, Torres, like 62% of the country, doesn't have a college degree. Like 45% of the country, he has had a family member in prison. Like 40% of the country, he has been on government assistance for more than 3 years of his life. Like 27% of the country, he is estranged from at least one family member. And like 58% of the country, his everyday breakfast is just a cup of coffee. For what it's worth, the breakfast of choice for the actual Speaker of the House, California's Nancy Pelosi, is chocolate ice cream. Sure, on top of all of that, Torres is gay, and unlike 77% of his colleagues in Congress, he isn't white. His 34 years are dwarfed by the average age of congressional members, 58 in the House and 64 in the Senate. But he doesn't bring his gayness or skin color or youth to Congress as much as he brings what being gay and non-white and young have taught him about community, about equality, about fairness, about justice, and about opportunity, or more succinctly, about America. Every elected official brings to their position a life of experience no one else could, a childhood of hardship or privilege, the shadow of apparent success or the heartache of a child's death, the college professor who told them they wouldn't amount to anything, or the fourth grade teacher who told them they were everything, the uncle who succumbed to complications due to AIDS, the sister who beat cancer, the ex who became a junkie, the classmate who became a judge, the friend who runs a hedge fund, or the neighbor who runs a daycare. The series of relationships and moments that add up to the everyday and that slowly accrue to a life. These are what a politician brings to the table, what shapes their ideas, their priorities, their votes, and ultimately their power. Robert Smalls, a representative of South Carolina in the 1800s, was born into slavery but freed himself and then created the country's first required public school system. Daniel Inouye, a representative from Hawaii, served 53 years in Congress despite being rejected for signing up for the military in World War II because of his race. He was Japanese American. His public service, he said, was encouraged by his mother, a homeless Japanese orphan who was taken in by a Hawaiian family. She told Daniel it was his responsibility to repay her debt to Hawaii. In the current Congress, Katie Porter of California, Cori Bush of Missouri, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan are three of the country's roughly 9 million single mothers. Congress's youngest member, North Carolina's Madison Cawthorn, who was elected in 2020 at 25, sought divorce after less than a year of marriage last year. Ocasio-Cortez is currently engaged. Georgia's Marjorie Taylor Greene is currently divorcing. These are lives in the everyday flux of any of our neighbors. The newest incoming class of Congress includes Florida's Maxwell Alejandro Frost, whose birth in 1997 makes him the first Gen Z member of Congress, and California's Robert Garcia, who became an American citizen after being undocumented and will become Congress's first openly gay immigrant. Congress is now rapidly diversifying with every election. And yet, even as Torres's demographics are interesting and original, they are not necessarily prescriptive. There are lots of ways to be Afro-Latino and gay. Black voices on the Supreme Court range from Clarence Thomas to Ketanji Brown Jackson, and women's voices in Congress range from that of the progressive Ocasio-Cortez to QAnon flirter Green. Torres is more than the sum of the various identities on any form he could fill out. Any legislator can declare a war on poverty, as did Lyndon B. Johnson, who grew up poor. Any legislator can spend hours touring poor neighborhoods in an effort to understand the chaos, as did Ted Kennedy, who grew up rich. Torres? He's using his limited power. He is only one of 441 members of the House of Representatives, after all, and a freshman at that, to try to pick off the problems he knows best. Whatever you call his mojo, confidence, swagger, arrogance, self-esteem, reclaimed power, Torres's identity is rooted in the tangled awareness that his life's crises and setbacks and tragedies have not been born out of his blackness, his queerness, his Latino heritage, or his zip code, but rather the systems of bigotry, bias, exclusion, and inequity that were, and still are, seeded into his life's harvests by America's intrinsic brokenness in its eternal quest toward a more perfect union. There was no model, no precedent, Torres says, of his ascent into Congress. I had to create a model of my own. That untested quality of his life has amplified his introvert tendencies. I am reflective by temperament, he says, but also by necessity. So yes, he's the first openly gay Afro-Latino person elected to Congress. What now? What next? What's he going to do with that faith and power and trust? Along the boundary of Fordham University in the Bronx is a modest yellow house. Behind it, on the same property, is an even more modest detached unit. Torres lives on the second floor of that in a one-bedroom apartment. His rent is $1,300 a month. His congressional salary is $174,000 a year. Discarded chicken bones and ravaged cartons of beer litter the driveway, which is lined by a barbed wire fence. Early one recent morning, Torres beckons me to his porch. I'm not allowed inside. Nobody is, except Angel Vasquez, his chief of staff. He points to a pile of at least a dozen garbage bags outside. It attracts a raccoon, he says. Can you believe I live next to this? He's been thinking about moving because of an increase in violent crime nearby. Officers shot in November 2021 and January 2022. An 11-month-old girl shot in the face by a stray bullet. A 16-year-old girl killed by another stray bullet from a ghost gun. As a neighborhood's congressional representative, he attends memorials. As a resident, he fears for his safety. His trauma can sometimes feel like it's in his blood. His maternal great-grandmother was murdered, he told me in the casual dispensing of horror that has long blighted America's forgotten margins. Slightly after Rihanna, but slightly before Adele, Torres was born in 1988 alongside his twin brother, Ruben. He also has an older sister, Melissa, by another father, and raised by his single mother in Throgs Neck Houses, a public housing project known for broken heaters, leaky pipes, lead paint, mold, rats, and roaches. He got stuck so often in the building's elevators that he still carries a fear of them. In his earliest awareness of class divide, in his younger days before attaining political power, Torres was both confused and enraged that across the street from his derelict home, the city was giving around $100 million to develop a golf course, which was eventually opened by Donald Trump. "That's when I realized I can't take for granted that the system will work out for me," he says. Growing up, he mostly kept to himself. He was always underweight and was frequently hospitalized because his environment's unsanitary conditions gave him severe asthma. He was beaten up at school, once by several boys who kicked his head. One of them ended up murdering someone a few years later, Torres recalls. "If I had sent my boy to school all battered and bruised like that, I've had child services at my door," says his mother, Debbie. "But his school sent him home to me like that and just says, boys will be boys." Debbie rotated through a scramble of here and gone jobs, a Domino's delivery person one week, a mechanic's assistant the next, whatever it took to make rent, which was capped at 30% of her income with no minimum. A typical month, she says, brought in roughly $400, which would have meant $120 in rent. Desperate to help out, Torres once panhandled on the subway, bringing home a bag of $180, mostly in coins from one day's effort, Debbie recalls. She nonetheless quickly discouraged it for fear he'd get mugged or have a run-in with cops. At the time, the Bronx was one of five counties in the nation where more than 30% of households were run by single mothers, according to a study by Lehman College. Three of those counties were on Native American reservations in South Dakota, the other in Mississippi. In speeches, Torres refers frequently to the single mothers of the Bronx as the community's core power players. "The essential workers of the Bronx," he called them at a food stamp event recently. "The essential mothers of the Bronx." In the context of the Bronx crucible of crises, Torres's race and sexuality are secondary to what has become perhaps the central focus of his legislative service, his love for his mother. "Voters came to see me as their son and grandson," he likes to say. A tight-knit family of, at last count, 732,872 people. Torres has almost no relationship with his father, Bartolo Torres. "I rarely saw him as a child and rarely see him as an adult," he says. "I feel no ill toward him. He always struck me as a good man." I ask him if he ever missed father-son moments like learning sports or how to shave. "It's hard to miss something I never experienced," he says. Last year, Torres ran into Bartolo in the street. They exchanged terse pleasantries. It was the first time Torres had seen him in a long time. I asked Torres who his father is to him today. His answer comes quick and cold. "He's my constituent." These are the kinds of things Richie Torres does as a congressman. He co-authored a letter to federal health agencies, including the CDC, asking to require insurance coverage of an injectable form of PrEP, the daily pill that helps prevent HIV infection at no cost to patients. Torres is not on PrEP. He advocates to permanently expand the child tax credit because it offers a safety net during children's shaky early years, a precarity he himself barely survived. He authored and pushed to passage a bill that would extend the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which requires financial institutions to collect data on credit applications submitted by small businesses owned by minorities or women, to include LGBTQ+ applicants too. He frames his priorities as an understanding that for many of our nation's problems, we blame the ignorance of the masses, but it's actually the malevolence of the elite. He is keenly aware how dependent the status quo is on everyday people being too busy or tired or worn down to stand up for themselves. Even liberal programs, he says, preach redemption but practice revenge. Torres was a third-generation resident of public housing. His grandparents had lived there since the 1950s. He began high school in Manhattan but withdrew when he became too homesick and enrolled in nearby Herbert H. Lehman High School. Inspired by the discovery on the MySpace page of Justin Pitts, a young social studies teacher at Lehman, that Pitts was gay, the first out person Torres had encountered to his knowledge, Torres came out at 16 during a debate about gay marriage. Pitts brought Torres to the latter's first pride parade the next year, but it didn't herald an era of many new experiences. Torres didn't attend prom, and his romantic life was limited to a single makeout session with a fellow student, an accomplished violinist. Despite the relative liberation of coming out, Torres began to feel depressed. He played hooky. He spent most of his time alone. "I experienced psychomotor retardation," he says. "I felt like my IQ had fallen by 20 points. He got accepted to NYU, then billed as America's top dream school. Its cost was tempered by federal grants and a scholarship. But this bright new chapter didn't help his mental health. The dorms had a room he said was known as the dungeon, where kids did drugs. "I saw more drugs at NYU than I did in the housing projects of the Bronx," he says. His roommate was friends with a young Hollywood actor, and the three of them once smoked marijuana, Torres's first time. Much to the actor's irritation, Torres recalls, the future congressman blew smoke in his face as he recited the actor's catchphrase. Torres soon started abusing other drugs, although his candor on the matter does not extend to naming the drugs. He had become an overnight caretaker for his grandmother during his senior year of high school, and she died his freshman year of college. She'd called him a few days earlier to tell him she loved him. Although he enjoyed some of his classes, especially his philosophy courses, he dropped out of NYU. He thought back to happy moments and recalled that as a high school student, he had shadowed a local community board leader, James Vaca, and had enjoyed it. He soon began working for Vaca, who had since become a member of the city council. Torres was making just $16,737 a year, but making a new life for himself with it. Yet the depression got worse. He was not formally diagnosed until he was admitted to a hospital after attempting suicide by overdosing on Tylenol. He was not surviving. He was persisting. After his grandmother's death, dropping out, his essential recloseting since that brief bravery at 16, and his attempted suicide, he began to reassemble his life at a 3-week rehab center. He returned to his work for Vaca, conducting housing inspections to document the vile living conditions in his downtrodden borough. His frustration that those in power were so far removed from the reality of Bronx brokenness prompted him to try an unlikely run for city council. He won a seat at 24, becoming the youngest member of the 51-person council. Now he's a congressman, running stronger in his sophomore season of politics than ever seemed possible in his sophomore year of college. He won his primary this year without a challenger, won his re-election with 82.6% of the vote, and began his second term in January, an affirmation of his political power and prowess not granted to every first-time member of Congress. Still, he's a man who takes an antidepressant for his depression but doesn't see a therapist. He tries to eat well, but on the day I shadow him in D.C., that morning coffee is followed by nothing but crunched breath mints until a 9 p.m. nibble of spinach dip and a few fries. He sleeps maybe 4 or 5 hours a night and has only recently begun to exercise regularly despite belonging to a gym. He's now on a late-night weightlifting kick. He has lived to see so many dreams come true. And yes, he's a United States congressman, but he doesn't always feel like he's living his fullest self. One afternoon, as we walk through his district streets, getting greeted by constituents left and right, Torres says something that holds both the weight of his past and the freight he's trying to carry into the futures of 1,000 Richie Torreses. "There's nothing more gratifying than helping people see themselves in you, in the power of personal connection and the honor of kinship." He knows how much he and others like him have lost or had stolen. He knows that a life mired in poverty is lonely and exhausting, that it robs opportunity not just to get a good job or to get rich, but to have any kind of life at all, let alone one that you enjoy. He binge-watches Love, Victor and Love, Simon, teen dramas about the struggles and mysteries of sexual orientation, because he says, "I'm living vicariously the romantic adolescence I was denied." He doesn't want any other children of the Bronx to miss what he missed. Scars all have stories, but they are often untold or even unacknowledged, he says. When New York's congressional districts were redrawn last year after being ruled guilty of gerrymandering, Torres, up for his first re-election, was the only member of the state's congressional delegation who made the trek to Bath, New York, the town of more than 11,000, where a judge was making decisions about new congressional districts that would hold for the next decade, 5 House terms. Torres drove 10 hours, 5 hours there, 5 back, to address the court for the 3 minutes to which he was entitled. He testified that there should be at least one congressional district fully encompassed within the Bronx, in keeping with tradition. That's his district. He got his wish. His closest comrade in Congress is his demographic opposite within the House among Democrats, Jake Auchincloss of Massachusetts, a straight, married, white, 34-year-old father of two with an economics and government degree from Harvard, an MBA from MIT, and service in the Marines that included tours of duty in Afghanistan and Panama. Torres is the only member of Congress who has been invited to dinner with Auchincloss and his wife. "He's just incredibly smart, and that intellect comes through in very short order when you're talking to him," says Auchincloss about Torres, with whom he serves on the Financial Services Committee. "He thinks about things in a sophisticated way, the fundamental driver of events and how things are going to play out. And he's extremely, extremely good on the policy issues he's dedicated himself to. He came to Massachusetts for an event in my district on housing. I invited maybe 24 housing experts, people with decades in housing policy who really know their stuff at the local, state, and federal level. And in a 90-minute conversation, he absolutely blew them away. They're still talking about it a year later. His depth of understanding of housing policy combined with his own lived experience is a 1-2 punch. Auchincloss adds, "We need more of the curiosity and humility that Richie brings, and more of his impatience for bullshit." Newark's Mondaire Jones, who was sworn in alongside Torres as the first openly gay black member of Congress, but will not be joining him in Congress's next term, met Torres in 2018 at a legislative conference in Albany when Jones was still a lawyer at a big firm. "He has inspired me like he's inspired so many queer people of color through his own very public journey," says Jones, who co-wrote the PrEP letter with Torres. "It's the fact that we both grew up poor in addition to growing up closeted and black. Richie helped me think about identity in a better way. We had just won, and I was growing frustrated with the number of interviews that people in the media wanted to give on the subject of making history as the first openly gay black members of Congress. And what he says to me was, 'You should be happy that people are covering our race because that will fade, and then the coverage will become tougher once we start serving.'" Torres pays a price, literally, for his intersectional identity in the form of caucus dues. $7,500 here and $8,250 there for an annual total of $30,950, just one more caucus fee shy of the median annual wage in America of $37,586.03, just to be himself. He was stymied by the Black and Hispanic caucus's prohibition on dual membership until he wrote an essay in the Washington Post complaining of the restriction. Torres is not the first politician to utter unpolitic thoughts, not by a long shot, but he seems particularly unafraid, sometimes to the extent that you wonder if we want our politicians to be this candid. In an interview with City and State, a magazine of New York politics, he touted his raw talent for oratory and rhetoric in the same breath that he said, "I speak better than most white people," in response to people accusing him of having, quote-unquote, spoke white. In May this year, he told a class of graduating high school seniors that they didn't need to go to college, citing Abraham Lincoln as an example of how far a person can go without a college education. When I ask him if he has a favorite Yankee, given that Yankee Stadium is in his district, he shrugs and says, "I lack the tribal fervor that baseball requires." He can seem ignorant, as when I ask if he has interest in an array of plays about gay black life, then running on and off Broadway, two of which had won Pulitzers. Another shrug. "I have a pretty good sense of what it's like. I don't need to see a play about it." And when Vasquez, his chief of staff, who is soon getting married at a city hall ceremony, says that his fiancée is stressing about her hair and makeup for the big day, Torres seems genuinely perplexed. "Why does she care about hair and makeup if you're just getting married at city hall?" he asks. Over Labor Day weekend, he took his first vacation in almost a decade, piloting a speedboat with friends on Saranac Lake near Lake Placid. Until then, he had never taken a proper vacation from his political life, never left New York for any reason other than work, including his visits to his ancestral Puerto Rico. His last vacation was in 2014 when he spent a weekend on Fire Island, a gay beach paradise, reading The Economist. His leisure reading these days is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, by the journalist and historian Ann Applebaum. He likes Basil Rathbone's 1940s Sherlock Holmes films. He keeps a jar of earplugs at his office desk in Congress to help tune out the world when he reads. He defers questions of style to Vasquez, whose nickname in the office is Straight Eye for the Queer Guy. Torres frequently sends his staff emails at 3 a.m. His go-to pizza is plain cheese because most toppings are unimpressive. He is often deadpan or humorless, but just occasionally with the gloating yet charming ba-dum-bum delivery of "see what I did there" dad jokes. He used to be so nervous before speeches that he would gulp a glass of wine first. He tries to call Debbie once a day to check in. Asked how he spent his birthday in March, he replied by citing an annual tradition of taking her to dinner at Peter Luger, a legendary steakhouse in Brooklyn. His mother's Twitter handle, despite having two other children, is @Richie's mother. He wants so much for her and for the other essential mothers of the Bronx. What does she want for her boy? I always wanted Richie to have a son just like him, a clone, she says. I could help raise my grandson in the White House. And dogs, because you've got to have dogs in the White House. But yeah, I will leave the housing projects for one place only, the White House. At 34, Torres does not meet the minimum age requirement for the presidency, so Debbie will have to wait at least until March 2023. I can wait, she tells me. He's always been worth the wait. Do you know Richie was delayed in talking? I was concerned. I took him to the pediatrician. But let me tell you, once he started talking, he didn't stop. He was so quiet when he was very little, but he sure made up for it now. Over a recent night of dinner and drinks across Times Square with his inner circle of friends, Vasquez, a Broadway producer, a lobbyist, a real estate developer, and a self-identified philanthropist, I ask about how much Torres's life has transformed over the past decade. The lobbyist twirls her straw in her cocktail and sighs, "I'm waiting for him to be transformed by love," she says. Torres has had plenty of dates in his life, but never a boyfriend. His friends pass around the Instagram profile of a man another friend had recommended as Torres's new paramour, a mostly headless, even more mostly shirtless profile of a Ukrainian immigrant. Sipping his mango mojito, Torres looks at the man's 8-pack abs, mentioning them frequently as the images are passed around, and then gazing at them himself while mumbling, "Impressive." Torres is a curious character, lonely even in a crowd. As an elected official, he says, "I am rarely alone, but often lonely." But he's far more singular than merely single. I've known Torres since 2014, when I wrote about his efforts as a new city council member to build a community center for elderly gay people in the Bronx. In 2018, I texted Torres asking him for recommendations of romantic restaurants in the Bronx. "I don't know offhand, but I could ask around," he wrote back. I quipped that it might help him get more romance in his life to know these spots. "I'm a lost cause," he replied. I joked that the line should be his campaign slogan if he ever runs for mayor, but I also sent a video of a Rose of Jericho's reblossoming and reminded him nobody is a lost cause in New York City. As his political good fortune has skyrocketed, I've often thought about his reply. "My mayoral prospects are greater than my romantic prospects." When I recently reminded him of this exchange, he was nonchalant about it. He is never, ever chalant. "I'm lonely," he repeated. "But it's not so bad." He strives for his lived experience of excellence and ascent to bloom for everyone, regardless of identity. He wants plainly and firmly to share the wealth of his good fortune so extensively and intrinsically that America is brimming with public housing residents winning elections, with college dropouts penning op-eds in the Washington Post, and with survivors of suicide celebrating many more steak dinners with their mothers. He doesn't want to be the only one of his kind anymore. He aches for his achievements, not to make him a breakout star, but instead just another casually glittering corner of a new firmament for new heavens. Congressman Richie Torres is trying to be normal, bless his heart. Our next article by Rosalind S. Frazier is titled, "Just 10 Minutes of Working Out Could Save Your Life." You don't need us to tell you that exercise is important. Even still, fitting in a workout can be tough, especially when you take into account the National Physical Activity Guidelines that suggest 2 strength training days and 150 minutes of weekly moderate intensive aerobic activity. So when news of a new study came out that even just 10 minutes of activity a day could literally save your life, we were all ears. The research, which was published in JAMA Internal Medicine and included 4,840 adults who exercise regularly as well as those who are more sedentary, estimated that if all adults in the U.S. over age 40 increased their activity by 10 minutes each day, about 110,000 deaths could be prevented each year, explains Pedro St. Maurice, PhD, lead study author and epidemiologist in the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics at the National Cancer Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. Doing even more, say 20 or 30 minutes of exercise, extended the health benefits, cutting back on 209,459 and 272,297 preventable deaths, respectively. But the advantages aren't just for the over 40 set. St. Maurice says the research projected similar benefits for men and women, Mexican-American, non-Hispanic Black, and non-Hispanic White adults of various ages. Need a little extra motivation to get out there and sweat? Beyond extending your life, it will make you feel a lot better. While this is a little obvious, it's worth the reminder. As we age, we tend to lose muscle, our hormones start to change, weight creeps up if we aren't careful, our mobility decreases, and our chances of cognitive decline start to increase, explains Joe Holder, founder of the Ocho System and a Nike master trainer. Literally all of this can be impacted beneficially with exercise. Holder suggests thinking about these little short activity sessions as exercise snacks to make them feel less daunting. And rather than trying to find time, think about things you already do that you can add movement to. For example, maybe you work remotely and have a weekly update call that doesn't require you to be chained to your laptop. Consider popping in your earbuds and taking the dog for a walk. Or perhaps you usually sit in the car and listen to a podcast while your kid is at soccer practice. Instead, listen to that podcast while walking around the field. The bottom line, a longer life may be within your reach, but you are going to have to get moving for at least a few minutes a day. And rather than trying to find time, think about things you already do that you can add movement to. For example, maybe you work remotely and have a weekly update call that doesn't require you to be chained to your laptop. Consider popping in your earbuds and taking the dog for a walk. Or perhaps you usually sit in the car and listen to a podcast while your kid is at soccer practice. Instead, listen to that podcast while walking around the field. The bottom line, a longer life may be within your reach, but you are going to have to get moving for at least a few minutes a day. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.